This podcast is brought to you by Underwriters Laboratory, Workplace Health and Safety.
So the first title we're going to release is more informational for organizations, and it's really designed to help educate the entire population related to the new view of safety. So we get into looking at how the best-in-class organizations are utilizing these techniques to drive improvement, but ultimately set up the rest of the content that will be coming online at the end of the first quarter. This first module will be available for free, and we'll announce soon when you're able to access that content as well as where. Thank you.
This cool stuff's available at Underwriters Laboratory, workplacehealthandsafety.com. Think about it, you guys. They're great sponsors, and thank you for doing that. And now, let's get on with the podcast.
They had the pilots, they had the passengers, they had the aircraft, they had everything there, except the thing that caused it. That had disappeared as if by magic.
Everybody, welcome to the Pre-Accident Podcast. I'm your host today, Todd Conklin, and you're in for a treat today, I think. We'll see if this all works. It's technically a mess, but, you know, I'm never afraid of a technical mess, that's for sure. Everything's great here. I hope you're doing good. The podcast is just rocking and rolling. Thanks for all your feedback, everything you're saying, all the good things that are happening. I really appreciate it. It's, the year's zooming by, and my whole premise of slowing things down, I've already told you I'm a mess. I cannot do that. But other than that, I would say it's a really good year. Tons and tons of interesting stuff. So today is a really interesting podcast. I'm going to jump right into it because I think you'll like today. It's going to be really interesting. I spoke at a meeting in Denmark with Oil and Gas Denmark, and I got to speak with a guy named Peter Burkle. And I actually asked him if I could record his presentation because he told the story of his plane crash. And Peter's really a great guy. In fact, we can talk to him a lot more. If you want to hear more, I'm more than happy to get a hold of him and get him on board. He was flying for British Airways. He was on Flight 38. The call sign for that plane, which you just heard in the opening of this podcast, is Speedbird 38. And they were doing a normal old flight from Beijing to London on October 17th, 2008. And at about noon, 12:30 really, his Boeing 777 crash-landed at the opening apron to the runway. They'd done the whole entire flight. I mean, the entire whole flight, and got to the point where the plane was just right at the apron of Heathrow, and it had fuel starvation, and it crashed, and nobody died. In fact, 152 people were on board, and nobody died. It's a remarkable failure, and it's a failure that I don't know how much you heard about or not. And what's interesting about Pete, and he's going to tell the story of this event and how it feels to him, is that it had nothing to do at all with operator error. Nothing. But no pilot error at all. In fact, what happened is the plane formed its own kind of slush puppy, its own slush sickle, and had fuel starvation, and they brought it in as carefully and as safely and without the least amount of impact they could possibly have into this airport. And I want you to hear Peter tell that story. And so let me cut away now and play Peter Burkle at Oil and Gas Denmark 2016. I think you're going to enjoy what Pete has to say. Listen carefully. This is a pretty cool little conversation. Until then, more on the backside.
This is me, Pete Burkle. And as it says there, I was the captain of this BA-38. Back in January 2008, it was actually 12:41 p.m. on a cold January day. I remember it well. Briefly, actually Martin's told me a little bit about himself, education, how I got into flying, trained at Prestwick, Scotland, joined British Airways in 1989 after having been a a mini lab sales rep for 2 years with Kodak UK. Just waiting for flying to start, really. And joined BAE in 1989. So flew TriStar, Lockheed L-1011s for a couple of years. Went to fly for Kuwait Airways to help them out after the war. Back, started flying DC-10s for about 5 years. Loved those aircraft, brilliant. And then I joined the Boeing 777, which is, that's a sad-looking one in the picture, but that's a 777. I started flying those in 96, so 18 years ago. Can't believe they're that old. I've done actually 27 years now. I'm obviously giving you the wrong info there, but 27 years flying, 17,500 flying hours. Well, I remember most of them. So, during those 27 years, I've obviously experienced a number of events. You've got to imagine all this. I'm sure you will fly. You will do, because you're working for... Oh, my God. So, actually, just out of interest, how many of you remember... Because I've been talking to a number of people today, and I've come across three people who actually know who I am and remember this event, but I don't know how many, a little show of hands, how many people in the room actually remember this event, because it's, oh, okay, cool. Sorry, you're going to get bored then, because this is just about that. The rest of you might enjoy this then. So this is what I'm here to do today, to talk to you about. It's a true event. I was the captain on this flight, as it says, and we suffered an unknown event, short finals over London. We were about 1,500 feet when the event started, fully configured for landing, and we started getting some unknown events happening. It was unprecedented in aviation, and unfortunately they had me at the controls. I am your average employee. I score mid of the lines, maybe just above average, but they probably would have preferred to have their ace there, but they had me. And I'll tell you later on how I felt, but it's certainly to have that thrust on you with no extra time to be able to analyze was stressful, to say the least. But me and the team, we worked together. David would be proud of that. I said we straight away, not me, not I, they, whatever, but me, we. Anyway, I had very little time to deal with this. Sometimes you don't quite know what life's going to throw at you. Gordon mentioned earlier, Gordon talked about zero injuries, zero casualties. I was like that once. I had 0-0 in my personal logbook. Unfortunately now it's about 21 injuries and 0 casualties. So that answers one thing. There were no casualties on this event, which was great. Apart from the aircraft, that was written off. But I've got 21 injuries and 0 casualties. The first injury I had was a stewardess over the Rockies, and we hit severe turbulence and that massive pocket just out of the blue. And she was in the back galley, and she just got airborne and smashed her head on the way down on a lock on the side of a canister. I heard about it in the front, like, oh my God, is she okay? Well, we don't know. She's sat down. I said, we've got a paramedic, ex-paramedic, haven't we, one of the crew. Said, get her on casement. That's her. So that was one of my first diversions for a long time, actually. That was only about 5 years ago. And I felt very bad for her, because she was in a bad way, vomiting, and I thought, yeah, she's got some bad injuries. So we elected to get her on the ground as soon as possible, and we got the ambulance to meet her. She's fine now, but she's a tough cookie. But yeah, typical, isn't it? When you want your paramedic crew, that was her. What happens to normal flight preparation? This is a 777 arriving at Gatwick, actually. This was my first retirement flight. Doesn't sound right, does it? My first retirement flight. But I retired at the VA after this flight, incidentally. So it's quite a nice photo for me. It was a lovely blue sunny day at Gatwick. So once the flight arrives like this, obviously all the passengers disembarked and we've got off, then the next crew are already getting ready to prepare that aircraft to move on. So in Beijing, the flight arrived on time, I think, and it would have been getting ready prepared for departure. So first people get on, normally the cleaners, they're usually waiting for the crew to get off, so they'll be on straight away to clean all the rubbish from the previous customers. And they never clean the flight deck, actually, but that's for us to do. So they clean all the rubbish, then you've got the flight engineer, the ground engineers come on board, they will check the tech logs and mend anything that's gone wrong on route. So IFE equipment from the first class passengers who've been using it wrong. And hopefully they'll mend any big issues that we've got in our yellow pages up front, which are, I always think, far more important than the pink ones down the back. So they mend our aircraft if there's anything wrong with it. And they'll change, the water waste will be removed, of course. They'll top up the fresh water tanks. They'll check the hydraulics. They'll probably start on the fueling before we get there. That's all done within about the first 40 minutes. And they'll be aiming to look at turning this aircraft around in about an hour and a half. Then we arrive. Flight crew arrive at the airfield about an hour to go. Hopefully get on board the aircraft with a good 45 minutes to go. And then we start doing our briefings. In the old days, in these days, Beijing, we still have paper briefings. Nowadays it's all on the laptops and we can have a look at that before we get to the aircraft. So that saves time nowadays. But in those days it was paper briefing. And we'd have checked all that. It would have information about the whole route. Not only the weather at Beijing where we were taking off from, but it would have the information of all the airfields en route that we might need to use for the paramedic stewardess who's knocked her head. So we have all the weathers for those, and of course, more importantly, everyone wants to get to destination, so we'd have the destination weather for London Heathrow, and we'd be looking at that. And it was not a bad day, actually, either end. It was about minus two in Beijing, 10 northerly wind, slight light snow shower, I believe, I remember. So it was a cold, wintry day. London was a dry January, cold, blustery day, but no precipitation forecast, so it looked pretty good either end. Our big issue for the briefing, or as David says, certification, we still call them briefings, but we cover his requirements for certification. Quite interesting, I listened to his speech very, very interestingly, because his certification was basically our briefing that we do certainly in British Airways. Basically, there's no closed questions. We'd never ask, well, as a captain, I'd never say, so you're happy with 80 tonnes then for this route? Yeah, you've got to generate that training in your first officer. So you're always asking them questions. What would you do? How would you do that? Which buttons are you going to press if this happens? And it's very much an open briefing. So that's like David Noggett's certification, but we still call them briefings. I think it's an easy word to say. Yeah, we do a lot of touch drills as well in that. I think he mentioned about doing touch drills. We still do touch drills, and we certainly wouldn't move anything without someone else's nod, basically. So if I went to press a button in flight, I should have my hand slapped in an emergency from my co-pilot, and you'd be quite right to do that. And I'd go, sorry, was I touching something without asking? So it's all very much in commercial flying, it's very much I do, he follows, he copies, he monitors what I'm doing. It's very much a two-man show. So, briefing is over, then we decide on the fuel. We don't just fill them up. We don't take as much fuel as we can. We could fit about 120,000 1,000 kilograms of fuel. I don't know what you guys deal in. Don't know how many barrels that is, but quite a lot. 120,000 kilograms would fill up a 777, but that would be far too much fuel. That would be about a 13.5-hour flight. We only had a 10.5-hour flight. So we elected to take minimum fuel, which was about 80,000 tons. So it's about two-thirds full. But it was cold fuel. This is important for later on. It's a cold day. The fuel on the ground was cold. So I think I remember looking at the fuel gauge and the temperature on the ground when they filled us up with 80 tonnes, the fuel temperature was already about minus one. So that was already quite cold for a refill. And then what happened with someone walked around the outside, one of us guys, check everything's where it should be, kick the tyres, usual things. Get back in. I'd like to be sat in my seat with 30 minutes to go, 30 minutes before departure. And then start loading the flight management computers, just checking the route between us. Co-pilot will be doing the performance for takeoff, so we've got enough power to actually get airborne, which is quite important, really. So that needs to be calculated. So all that's done, and then 20 minutes to go, I'd like to be ready to brief for the not the briefing for the routes. We've done that. This is another brief, another certification. This one's about emergencies, and this is where you talk about what's going to happen if we lose an engine on departure. What are you going to do? Where's the safe place to go? So we talk about all that, probably about 10, 15 minutes of emergency briefings, and 5 minutes to go, run the first checklist, quick PA to the passengers, and we're off. That's it. Can all do that now? So on the day, as I said, we did depart 1 minute late, but that's actually classed as on time, so that was good. So we set off on route. I dropped this basic route for you last week. It's basically a great circle route, and we try to follow that in flight planning as much as possible. So Beijing, obviously, on the far right-hand side, destination, far left. That route, 5,000 miles, should take about 10.5 hours on the day. So I think, was it David who was talking about the Navy? Yeah, it was the Navy SEALs. What's he up to? Yes, body deteriorating. So now this is a sort of body deteriorating flight for the Navy SEALs, I reckon. You know, they'd be wasted, wouldn't they? They'd be wasting away by the time we got to London. It explains a lot about me, actually. I used to be a Navy SEAL, I reckon. So yeah, 10.5-hour flight, 5,000 miles, 136 customers on board, 13 cabin crew, 3 flight crew. So I was in command of all that rabble. 2 first officers with me up front looking after me. And I always say they're looking after me because I'm in command. European legislation calls me a commander now, not a captain, but so I'm a commander. That's weird.
Commander.
Yeah. So captain sounds better, but still precocious. So Peter, right? But I always tell my boys, you know, you look after me, I look after you, we work together as a team, and it all fits together. It's all part of cockpit resource management, isn't it, Todd? Yes, CRM we call it for short. Big tool in aviation. So yeah, a lot of passengers from all walks of life. A lot of business passengers on this route. We get a lot of people from the mining contingent out in China and into Mongolia. They come back, fly there. We had a big Nokia contingent, mobile phones in those days, I remember. Yeah. That rings a bell. Yeah. And then the rest of it, probably the passengers in World Traveller, more tourist run. So we had quite a lot of tourists, a mixture between Chinese and English. So some were coming to Europe for a visit, and others were going back home. And I do remember a little Chinese family I met during the flight. I don't speak much Chinese. Hello, goodbye, thank you, good deal, bad deal, that's it. That's all you need. So I was chatting to them, but they had a cute little boy. And I, at the time, had 3 babies. All 3 of my boys were under 3. So this little boy just, you know, I just wanted to say hello to him and So I said, Nihao, that's it. And he looked at me, what's that funny man in the striped uniform? But yeah, he was toddling up and down the aisle. Joyce had a blue sweatshirt on, I remember. And I still think about them today, but they're fine. They're fine. And there was also one pregnant lady, she was 27-week pregnant. She would come up to her limit before she wouldn't be able to fly, so I remember there being a question asked about her just before departure. It's probably why I'm a minute late, actually, because I had to answer that query. But yeah, so she's heavily pregnant, so I was concerned about her later on. So yeah, the route takes off out of Beijing, took off at 0209 Zulu, pretty much on time. So on your body clock, it's pretty much middle of the night. But yeah, I had a good rest in the hotel the night before, so didn't feel too early. Sun's up, so that helps to get your circadian rhythm going. So took off at just past 02 Zulu, taking off towards the north, and straight over Mongolia. Usually you get a good view of the Great Wall just after departure. Certainly from the flight deck, lovely views. over Mongolia, and then over Irkutsk. That's near Lake Baikal for all you geologists among you miners. I think Lake Baikal is a massive lake, isn't it?
It's got it's the largest freshwater lake.
There you go. That's what I've got written down here. 20% of the world's fresh water is held in the one lake. This was 8 years ago. I think they've been using a lot of it. But, you know, I love views like that. And you just fly over and you see this mining town of Irkutsk next to the lake. And it just looks horrible from the air. But it's probably greyer and dustier on the ground, isn't it? I don't know. Anyway, fly over there. Past Krasnoyarsk and follow the Siberian Railway route a little bit, and then you go over River Ob, north side of Moscow, about 300 miles north we were, then into Europe. And actually, right overhead here on the day, that map's not exactly accurate, on the day we came over just over Copenhagen. So that's quite bizarre, I'm talking to you today. So when we get over that sort of area, Denmark, on that route, we would all be back in the flight deck because we would have had some rest during the flight because there's three of us. So we'd have had about 2 45-3 hour rests. So we'd make sure we're all back in the flight with 1 hour to go, and then we'd do another briefing. What did he call it? Certification. I'll call it a briefing because that's what I know. And again, you're trying to share your picture of what you're expecting to happen at Heathrow. So you're trying to create this mental model of the environment you're going to be flying into. So you'll be looking at the weather, how much fuel you've got on board, all this jazz. So it was a standard briefing on the day. I think John, my first officer, was operating the flight that day. So he was operating as the co-pilot, but he was flying the airplane. I was acting as his co-pilot, but obviously still being the captain in command of the whole aircraft. So John briefed me for what he was expecting to land, and it was all fine. We had loads of fuel. We were 20 minutes early, and yeah, what could go wrong? It's like lovely. So what we say in aviation speak is that on the sort of briefing, we plan for the expected. So you can always plan that because you know roughly what's going to happen, so that's easy to plan for. But we also prepare for the unexpected. Now, we never know quite what's going to happen, but we're always trying to prepare for something. So we maybe talk about a couple of scenarios per briefing about what might happen. But I certainly didn't talk about double engine failure, that's for sure. And just think about Copenhagen, actually. There's a little human side to this story, because I'd taken the last rest, so I'd come back in over Copenhagen for the briefing, jumped into my seat. I'd been asleep for 3 hours, so I needed some food, so I had a salad, and I remember it had a, it sounds strange, but it had a red salsa dressing or something, or it was a red sauce anyway, and I put a napkin on. I didn't have my tie on. put a napkin on because we really eat on our laps. It's like TV dinners on the flight deck. I sat there with this napkin on and it tucks in. Started eating, chatting to John. And I spilt a bit of sauce. And of course, what happens? Human facts is that the napkin doesn't work. It's already fallen down. It goes straight down my shirt. This red sauce, and I'm like, I said to John, and I can't believe I said this to this day, but I said, we better not crash, because they might think I've hurt myself, because this looks like blood. Well, the look on John's face was like, you can't say that. I said, well, okay, if we do, just make sure you remind me to put my tie on, because it's going to cover it up. But yeah, amazing, the little human story. I've never even said the word crash on the flight deck. You know, people don't. It's a no-no. It's like, I don't mention thunderstorms because that frightens passengers. You call them rain clouds, or you know, it's raining. But you certainly wouldn't say thunderstorms because people imagine the worst. So certain things you don't talk about, but I did. And lo and behold, an hour later, the inevitable happened. So, approaching to London Heathrow, 27 left. That's actually a picture of Mike, that was the registration. Golf Yankee, Mike on the approach. So how did the event unfold? Very late on, basically. So we've done the briefing. We had a quick hold. We talked about holding earlier. Quick hold around Lambourne, on the northeast side of London. We had loads of fuel. But I did notice the fuel had increased in temperature. I neglected to say, during the cruise over Siberia, the outside air temperatures dropped to minus 65 Celsius. Very cold. And our fuel temperature was dropping with it, because the fuel is stuck out in the wings, out in the open, basically, so it's going to cool down pretty quick. So we were keeping an eye on the fuel temperature. The limit was minus 47. That's when they thought fuel froze. Minus 47 degrees Celsius. So our limit was not to go below minus 44. So pretty close. But if it gets colder than minus 44, you do things about it, like you descend into warmer air or you speed up. Friction helps to warm it up. We didn't have to do that because we had a balmy minus 43 on the fuel gauge. However, when we got out of the Lambourne hole, coming through 20,000 feet, so about 10 minutes to landing. I do remember looking at the fuel gauge, and we had about 11.5 tonnes, which is nearly 2 hours flying time in the 777s. We had tonnes of fuel. But the fuel gauge warmed up, it was now minus 22. So, yeah, that would be cool, you know, everything's fine. At 1200 feet, we were all fat, dumb, and happy over Kew Gardens in Richmond. We were now fully configured for landing, so the gear down, full flaps. Landing checklist all done, and everything was good. So I was flying at this stage for John's approach. So I'm flying the aircraft in autopilot, and we start picking up some gusty winds. And when the wind blows on an aircraft, I'm sure you've all been, especially living up this part of the world, landing in gusty wind conditions, the throttles on the aircraft will go up and down to keep the speed constant of the aircraft, but it does sound horrible down the back where you've got the engines thrusting and then retarding, thrusting, retarding. That's what was happening on this flight. It's normal, but I did share this, again, sharing my mental model with John. I said, look, this isn't me, this is the auto throttles, so they do it on their own. So the auto throttles are doing that, I'm not being rough. So it's quite gusty out there. When you take control for your landing, just be mindful of that. Yeah, good. So 800 feet, he takes control. 720 feet, so 3 seconds after John's taken control, so I've just relinquished control, so I'm now changing my paper plates, which are now on the iPad, so it's all different now. I was changing the page to the landing page, and I remember he says something to me, you know, Pete, were the throttles doing this when you were flying? And I'm thinking, yes, is it the gusty winds? Bit of a closed question, looking back, you know. I could have worded it differently, but he's saying, I don't know. As he was talking about that. We were having an engine failure, but the aircraft didn't think we had an engine failure, so we had no warnings. What John was getting was the right engine thrust was increasing to try and get more power. The aircraft didn't know there was a problem because the engine was actually just about turning over. It hadn't properly failed. So we had no warning, so it's like, yeah, okay, it's just the wind, it's just the gusty winds. So now about 43 seconds, sorry, a bit accurate here, but it's the way it goes, every second counts. 43 seconds, we got clearance to land call from the tower. Quite early on, actually, normally a lot lower than that. So it almost took me by surprise. I went, well, that's early, but there was nobody in front of us, so it was nice. So I then, I have to reply to that, I have to respond. And you heard that earlier on in the tape that I played you. So I give the clearance to land call. It all takes a couple of seconds to do all that. Flip the lights on. That's my cue that we're clear to land. And it all still feels fine. But the little... And this is interesting. I think it was Gordon. Someone was talking about having interruptions and... didn't make a note of that. Distraction management, this is Fleming. Distraction management. This clearance to land call was a classic of that because John had started to share something that was happening to him. I then got interrupted by the ATC call to land and the conversation was almost forgotten because we still had no warnings, but a bit later on, the same thing was happening to the left engine. That was 7 seconds after the right one. So John was starting to feel happier because the left engine was going through the same scenario as the right. So now you got the right throttle almost full forward. The left starts to match it. So he's thinking, oh, okay, this is all going fine, but you know, there's an awful lot of power going on here. So he's not concerned about it anymore. I've sort of forgotten because he's not now verbalising anything that there's any problems. And there's still no warnings. But then it became clear that there was a big problem because John's hands were fully forward, being a first officer now, I have to use left hand controls. So he was now fully arm stretched, which you never saw. I've never seen it in the 12 years I've been on the 777. Just fully forward like that. But what got me was he said, help. Help Pete, I can't get any power. That's horrible. To hear the word help, you know, I've never heard another pilot saying help to me. And it's like, what do you mean you can't get any power? So I'm, you know, back in the loop now. And I look at his hand and it's fully forward. I'm like, that's just wrong. I look at the engine instruments and I can see that he's asking for full power because the gauges are fully forward. The white lines, it's demanding full power. I'm like, well, that looks right. It's demanding full power. John's arm's fully forward, but there's something wrong with the gauge. There's no power in the engines. The gauge was blank. And it was like, well, that's wrong. But I couldn't understand what was wrong about the picture because it had never happened. So it didn't make sense. And they both were the same. So it's like, normally they're fully white. It's all shaded in. Now they're black. So as my brain was trying to process this, John's verbalised to me, I've got a problem, help. I'm looking at the instruments going, something wrong with the instruments. My third pilot puts two together. He's got a good picture. He goes, looks like we've got a double engine failure. And that was brilliant. It put it all, we were all working from the same song sheet. And that made me think, I can't believe this is happening. So this disbelief was amazing. I still remember it now. It's like, but this can't happen. This is a 777, the most modern aircraft of its day. It's got so many redundancies. Why is this happening? You know, Todd talked about redundancies and spare capacities. And yeah, the 777 has two generators per engine. So if one fails, it'll use the backup one. You've got an APU generator in the back. So you've got five generators on a two-engine aircraft. You've got spare engines. You've got spare fuel pumps for each fuel system. You've got so many redundancies in the safety line that it shouldn't happen that this was happening. And yet it was. So I just couldn't believe what I was seeing. And then a bit further down, 370 feet, it was happening. It was still, you know, nothing was sorted out because this was literally 2 seconds later. I knew I had to do something about this. I got over this disbelief, which probably lasted half a second, because the aircraft's like, the runway's just there, it's a mile and a half away, and we're, you know, less than 400 feet, so I knew I had to do something. I'm a captain, I've got these four bars on my shoulder for a reason, and they suddenly felt very heavy that day. I'd only been a captain for about 4 years, and I suddenly thought, this is down to me. I need to do something, because this is not a good situation to be in. I remember thinking, well, we just have to go around, which is a, you know, missed approach. All we have to do is put the power on and go around and we'll sort this out. That's what we'd have done in the simulator, because you never get a double engine failure in the simulator. Certainly not one without any warnings. So I was like, yeah, we can't go around, we've got no power. I have to deal with this. I have to deal with this approach. I have to deal with the runway being too far away. We're not going to make that. I suddenly realised that runway is not achievable. So we are going to crash. It's inevitable. Is that word again? And so I had to get over that. Right, what can I do? It's got to be a simple problem. There's no warnings, so maybe the warning system's US. It's got to be a simple fuel pump problem. So my first big decision was to leave John flying the aircraft. He was flying it already. It was much safer in my mind to leave him flying it whilst I sorted the problem out. So John, keep control. I'll sort this out. Thinking it was going to be a simple fuel pump problem. So my hand went up. I did a quick scan for the top panel. Checked all the fuel pumps were on. Crossfeeds, I switched the crossfeed lines on, which basically extra pumps that run fuel from one wing to the other, just in case there was a fuel issue. Carried on down, autopilot, that's no use. Thrust levers, yeah, they're still forward. Speed brake, that's not down, because if the speed brake arm had come out and been activated, that's a massive amount of extra drag. So I made sure that was still up. I actually checked the fuel control switches still on, so that's like your ignition on the car. I just checked they were still in the run position. And I checked the fire handles were still down, because I don't know, I thought if they popped up, they switched the engines off, but that hadn't been heard of. But I remember just putting my hand down on them to make sure they were in the correct position, and they were. And I remember thinking, for a fraction of a second, I've got no other idea what is going on. And we had no warnings. Still no warnings. I was like, this is modern aircraft. What is happening? Why has this happened to me? This happens to people you read about in the press. You know, it's never me, but it's always someone else. But today it's me. And that was really confusing until 270 feet, literally, as I had my hand on those fire handles, the first warning came up. Airspeed low. And suddenly this quietness, which had been for the last 10 seconds, was obliterated by this horrible master caution warning. I'm like, oh my God, the warning system is still working. So I cancelled the noise and shouted out, airspeed low. Basically meant to John, do not get any slower, because we are back at stall speed. Because what had happened in the last 4 seconds or so was that we had no power. So the aircraft was coming down and down, but keeping on the same glide path. So it was having to reduce its speed to keep the same height, and getting a higher and higher angle of attack, but bleeding off its speed in the process. So we were now back at a horrible 10 degrees nose up at altitude, at minimum speed for the configuration we were at. So if we went any slower, continued down this slope, we would just stall and fall down. So this warning was saying, The warning's still working, guys. Don't go any slower. So John did a good job. He dipped the nose down. Because we needed the speed. If we didn't have the speed, we'd just stall. So he did a good job, started dropping the nose. Then I look out the front, like, where are we going to get to? Because we're crashing. But we're not going to get anywhere near the runway. Certainly not now. And I realised that how far we were going to get was this block of buildings, a catering block, short of London Heathrow, a place called Hatton Cross. There's also the nasty BP petrol station there, which wouldn't have been good. But this building was in my face. I was still low, but it was, that's where we were going into, that was our projection. I looked down at the vertical speed, how fast we're going in the vertical plane. That was a horrible 1,800 feet a minute. Normally, it would be 750. So we were plummeting down rather than a gentle glide. 1,800 feet a minute, that's horrible. And where we're going to impact, that's 100% of my passengers dead. You don't want to hit a building at 140 miles an hour. And I remember thinking quite clearly, not about myself or my co-pilot, I remember thinking about my customers. I thought, everyone's dead. If we hit that building, we're all dead. I never came into the appraisal, which I found quite interesting. Because I always said to guys, anyone who was concerned about flying, I said, look, don't worry about flying, because we fly the simulator all the time. And we put us through all sorts of scenarios, engine failures, it's no problem. We fly through anything, fires, and we always get the simulator down. So if we get the simulator down, then the rest of the plane will follow. So you'll be safe. But when it actually hit the fan, I wasn't actually thinking about myself. I became some sort of robot. And I was just there in a calm manner trying to work through the options. And I was worried about my passengers. And I often look back at that and think, if I'd been concerned about myself, I think I might have gone into some sort of a panic mode and got stressed about it and not being able to think clearly. So, but it's not nice to know you're going to kill all the passengers who put their trust in you. So what can I do? What can I do about that? Still had 20 seconds to go. So I know I'm waffling a lot, but it's all what was going through my head. Time really does slow down when you're in a stressful environment. I guess the adrenaline just pumps faster and your brain seems to work three times as fast. But still had 20 seconds to go. That's quite a lot of time, really. But this building was looking awfully close. I wasn't looking like I liked it, the thought of going into that. And then my training kicked in. I thought, right, okay, what can we do? And I used one tool we would use in the simulator all the time is a DODAR mnemonic. Basically, DODAR stands for diagnose the problem. What options have you got? Decide on your option, and then you assign the task and review. And that's DODAR. I don't like it, but anyway, it's what we use. I didn't have time to use that tool. I mean, that's an awful lot. And you would usually share that, obviously, with your crew. Another tool that we use a lot is CRM, Cockpit Resource Management. And we stole that from NASA. Am I right in saying that? Yeah. And British Airways have been using it ever since I joined 27 years ago. So we use CRM big time in the simulator. That's all about using everybody in the flight deck and saying, like, what do you think the problem is? Yeah, I think it's that as well. I think we've got a double engine failure. What options have we got? Well, I think we could restart the engine. Yes, possibly. We could crash, yeah. We could, you know, we can't go around. You know, so you play around like that. Well, we didn't have time for that nicety CRM stuff. That was my biggest tool. I always felt in the sim that was where I excelled. And suddenly that was taken away from me. And I felt robbed of my best tool. I remember being angry about that. If this isn't right, I just wanted a simple emergency. An engine failure would have been perfect, not two. You know, it was angry. So I had to ditch most of the donor, and I just went for the options. That's the only time I've got. And I had no time even to verbalise, because verbalising takes ages. You know, listen to me tonight. But interestingly, after this event, they changed donor to T-donor, and the T stands for time available. And, of course, even if it had T in front of this, I would have said, well, zero. But nowadays, in the simulator, we go, well, I've got 30 minutes, because I've got loads of fuel, so we've got 30 minutes to think about decisions and options. Well, I didn't. So I went straight to the options, and it became quite clear to me I had one option would be to raise the gear up, because that's the biggest form of drag, because this was all about trying to get further, but without any power available. So the only way to get further in an aircraft or a bird, say a feathered bird, is to stretch, is to reduce the amount of drag you've got. So a bird's feet, aircraft's undercarriage hanging down, that's a big amount of drag. So if you raise that up, or if you're landing on water like the Hudson, you want to raise the gear up and you've got a nice slimline belly, or you've got less drag. And I thought, no, I can't do the gear, because we're going to crash, and I need to crash on the gear. Because crashing on land, you need the gear, because it takes the brunt of the impact. So right, gear options out. What else have I got? Flaps. So my option to change the flap, which has become my pièce de resistance, I suppose. People know me for changing the flap. And pilots, even commercial pilots today, say, how did you think about that? And I tell them in about 5 minutes that it was my only option left. I had to reduce that land flap from 30 to 25 degrees. But we were, if you remember, already back at airspeed low speed, so we were back at the stick shaking speed. So it was the stick shaker was operating. It actually warns you two ways. It gives you a verbal noise. Hello.
So question. Flap change.
Sorry, I've got a little techie. Yeah. Okay. Flaps are the piece of equipment that hangs out the back of the aircraft, so it makes the wing larger. So takeoff we use a little bit, gives you more lift. Landing we use a lot more because we can fly slower. Bernoulli's theorem basically it makes the wing larger, and you can float down like a bird. Sort of. Except when you've got full land flap and it gets very draggy, and I needed to reduce that. So this was my second big decision really, was right flaps. And we're pretty low. That's like, God, I don't know, 20, 15 seconds or so ago. I thought, if I don't move this flap lever, we're going to hit that building. And 100% fatalities. If I move it to flap 25 and we stall, then we drop and everybody dies. If I move it and it works, like I think it will work, I might save some people. So what choice would you make? You'd move it, because that's the only one that gives you a chance of saving people. But I remember a hand went down again. I couldn't talk to John about it because the time constraints. So my hand went down to the flap lever, and another training tool came in my head, and I thought, I've been told not to move. If you're having to move part of the aircraft that is to do with flying safely, which flaps is, count to six slowly. If you've got to move that on your own, you haven't got someone else to confer with, count to six slowly. So give yourself some time, make sure it's the correct thing to do. So I remember putting my hand on that flap lever thinking, count to six. Well, I haven't got time to count to six. I've got to move it. And I moved it, and the relief was fantastic, because what happened was our rate of descent went from 1,800 feet a minute, the drag reduced, John was able to raise the nose slightly, and our rate of descent went to 1,200 feet a minute. So it was about halfway between normal and the worst. It was like fantastic. So this building, which had been sat on the horizon coming straight towards us, now started to go below, which means you're going to go above it. Fantastic. So I thought, this isn't a crash course, but I now thought, I've just saved people. And I had these figures in my head, and I clearly remember them. 50%, I thought, that's brilliant. And I felt so elated, as you can in that situation, but I remember feeling that I've done something good here. But then, 200 feet, so a little bit later, yeah, a second or two, still had some usable time, 10 seconds. Well, in this scenario, that's an immense amount of time. So I thought, right, I felt good, I'm doing some good things here. John's happy, you can see he's still flying it well. So what else can I do? I've got 10 seconds of usable time. 200 feet is a classic altitude for pilots. It's the time when you would, in an emergency, it's the time when you would be telling your passengers to brace. So it's that sort of late on. But they'd been briefed at that point. I had had no time up to this point to talk to my cabin crew or the passengers or even ATC at this point. It was so fast. These last 20 seconds have been rapid. So I was now down to this point thinking, what can I do? And I've got another mnemonic, training, again, PPP. I don't think I'd heard it for about 15 years, but some trainer had said, if you're ever short of time and you want a really quick, helpful tool, it's a bit like DODA, use PPP, stands for Plane Path People. Very easy to remember, and that's the importance of having time-constrained tools like this. They've got to snap in your head straight away. This one did, even in these situations. So I thought, Plane Path People, yeah, I'll use that. Plane, right, well, I've done what I can't sort that out. Path, I've sorted that out, the change of the flap. People, of course, what should I do? Shall I do a brace call? It's 200 feet. Mm, perfect. But I remember thinking, all in the split seconds, my passengers haven't been briefed. They haven't been rebriefed for 11 hours on the brace position. Half of them are Chinese. They won't understand if my cabin crew start shouting, brace, brace them. They'll all be sitting up and wondering what's going on. So I thought, they're sat there thinking we're going to do a normal landing. They're all relaxed. Yeah, they've all had a long journey. Their bodies have started to emaciate anyway. It's like a Navy SEAL. So I thought, leave them happy. And it was probably a difficult call for me. I mean, a lot of this is in the grey area. This whole flap change with no procedures to follow, because it was unwritten, yeah, unprecedented. So I'd been in this grey area for 20 seconds, and I had to develop, you know, I was at the pointy end and the blunt end of your stick. I was able to do everything, and it was quite tricky really, but that's the grey area, and I was in one, big time. But this PPP was very useful in the end. I thought, people, I won't do that brace call because I don't want to hurt people, because East Midlands crashed. It's a bit pilot speak now, but they switched the wrong engine off and they ended up the good engine that they'd shut down. They shouldn't have done. We've seen their bad engine, which they were flying on, finally conked out short of the runway, and they crashed short into the side of the motorway. They had a lot of fatalities, but they reckon a lot of them were badly injured because of the brace position, and it was wrong in those days. It was different from how we do it now. People used to interlock their hands. You know, you should never do that. It's because if you crash, your arms can't go anywhere. So always put palm on top of palm on your head, so then arms can separate. And if that's all you take home, that's great. You know, I might have saved someone's arm. And feet position was slightly different. So I thought, I want to get away from that whole brace call. What I'll do, is I'll do a mayday call. Because I've only got a chance to do one. I can't do a PA and a mayday call. We're about to crash. I want to get the emergency services en route to me, because I might not survive this. And that was my first time I thought about myself. And I thought, we're going to crash, possibly in the road, but definitely not on the runway. And I need those emergency services to come out as soon as possible. If I don't survive, they're going to take an extra minute or two. So I wanted them to come out straight away, so I did a mayday call. And then we hit the deck. I was still talking on the RT as we hit. It was quite bad, actually. Quite a bad landing. I'm never giving John another landing. It was, it's one of the worst. A normal landing distance would be 1,800 metres on the runway, sort of average stopping distance. So 1.8 kilometres. This was a 370 metre stop. So it was about 20% of the normal rollout distance. And it was so hard, I actually thought we had breached the hull down the back. So I still thought 20%, including my little Chinese boy, I didn't think he'd made it. So I still thought 20% off, 20% fatalities, which was much better than 20 seconds before. So things were, still good, but it was sad moment. We get to the evacuation, and of course, we were plummeting down those garden furrows there, and that's where I became a passenger, because you can't do anything to an aircraft when it's skidding along the ground. So I became a passenger at that point. I remember that feeling that this is where I finish, this is where I end. And I actually said goodbye to Maria and my three boys as we were trundling down the grass, and then we stopped. I didn't pick up the phone and phone them, so in my head I said goodbye. And then we stopped, and I felt a bit foolish for thinking I was about to die, and I didn't. I remember that. It's like, that was a bit silly. And you see, we sort of made the runway, just. but then it became a normal scenario. Then it became simulator. And I was back at the grey area. I was now in a comfort zone. That sounds odd, but this is what we're trained for. This was now a normal occurrence. So I was back in the simulator mode. Oh, okay, this is an evacuation. And it all became transparent. Like, well, I'll do this then, I'll do this now. Ask for the checklist and we run through it. We all come together at the end. Have you done your drills? Right, let's get out. Let's look after ourselves. And that was a nice feeling. We were comforted by being back in the simulator, back in a normal environment, if that can be normal. But it did feel reasonably normal. Still horrible, but good news was everyone got off. All sides worked. Everybody got off. And I remember coming down that door one right slide. Fire chief was at the bottom, and he said, "You're the captain." Of course, I didn't have my tie on. Are you okay? Yes, I'm fine. And he says, "Have you got any dangerous goods in the hold?" I'm like, "No, we're fine. There's 152 passengers and crew on board. How many?" I think I said, "How many have I killed?" It was worded slightly wrong, but I think I was a bit stressed. And he looked at me puzzled and went, "No, everybody's off." I went, "Yes, but how many are dead?" And he said, "No, I don't know how you've done it, but everyone's alive." That was a massive, massive relief to me. Fantastic feeling. So what actually happened? I talked about the fuel getting very cold during the flight. It never hurt. AIB investigators hadn't got an idea. It took them 2 years to investigate this event. They didn't know that this could happen. So the first time they saw it was when they took the whole of the fuel pipe of 777 to Edwards Air Force Base in Florida, which was the biggest hangar they could find that they could actually freeze. So they took this whole fuel pipe down to this big freezer, and they put it through the 10.5 hour flight, and they pumped exactly the amounts of fuel that we pumped through the pipes and exactly the same temperatures that we went through. And then after 10.5 hours they cut the pipe, and that's what they found. And that is ice formed from perfectly good fuel, and they didn't know it could happen. It was Korean fuel, actually. They started blaming the Chinese, but actually they realised that this fuel would come from Korea, being tanked up to Beijing. And it was some of the best fuel, because they had a whole wing full of it, so they were testing it. And they said, "This is the best fuel we've ever seen." But they said it just performs brilliantly. But it gets a bit viscous. I think it was minus 10 to minus 20, it starts getting viscous. Then it starts leveling off again between minus 20 and minus 30. And then between minus 30 and minus 40, it starts getting viscous again. So they were like, "We didn't know this happened to fuel, but now we do, and we can do something about it, and we can make the world a safer place." because this had happened a few times before, but it had cleared before landing. So nobody knew. This thing, this ice disappears. So the culprit is gone. You know, it's, Elvis has left the room. So it, that's why they didn't find it on landing, because it had gone. It melted. The fuel, well, they realised what happened. The ice had formed in the fuel pipe during the flight. When we went through the gusty winds over Kew Gardens, so when I was flying it, it's my fault, I know, throttles were going up and down. What they found happened is during the gusts, big amounts of power went on. The fuel demand from the engines demanded more fuel to power the engines. That extra amount of fuel dislodged the slightly warmed up minus 20 sludge, and it just hit this piece of equipment, the FOHE, which is the first component of the Rolls-Royce engine. That's basically full of 300 little capillaries, you can just see at the top. But the ice there blocked 95% of those capillaries. So it was like a slush puppy, and the engines couldn't suck the fuel through that ice quick enough to power them. And that's why the warning systems said there's no warnings, because they were getting just a trickle of fuel to keep them turning, but not enough to provide any power. So that was why it was all a bit confusing.
I always feel like I need to take a breath. I was there at the dinner, and Peter was amazing. And actually, we talked for hours and hours. I wanted you to hear this, because I wanted you to hear the operator talk about the failure and really tell the story, the context-rich explanation of how this event happened, and even more importantly, what his mindset was. And I know it was long. I'm sorry about that. I don't know what to cut, so it was difficult. And I know it was hard to hear, but I think the payoff in the long run is that you got to hear him say some things that I think are pretty important. When training matters and when it doesn't. What mnemonic tools come to mind, and how some of them are developed in a scenario that allows the luxury and capacity to have time, and how others are developed and there's just no time to use them. And how things like crew resource management, which is a tool they lean on, was not there until it was there. To me, the most interesting thing is when he said, I was the passenger on the plane, and then after we crash landed, I was relieved because it was normal again. These are things we simulate. Having the ability and the capacity to recover is everything. And I think Peter's story is amazing. I want to especially thank Denmark Oil and Gas, or Oil and Gas Denmark, for the permission to use this. But mostly I want to thank you for listening to it. I think this is a remarkable podcast. Listen to it a couple times. It's worth it. Just for us. It's so important to hear that mindset and context of an event that happened. So learn something new every day. Have as much fun as you possibly can. And for goodness sakes, be safe.